We live in a time where certain conversations can seem tense or even taboo. So to push back against this culture of silence, I sit down every other week with a different guest to talk about what they believe, what shaped that belief, and why it matters. My name is Tony Vicenda, and this is The Threshold. Welcome back, everybody, to Season 2 of The Threshold Podcast. We are so excited to have you join us for this interview. I'm also just super thrilled to be joined by one of our new co-hosts. Father Parrish will still be around from time to time, but I'm really excited to have you guys meet or re-meet if you listen to our last between-season episode, Mari V. Mari V, hey, how's it going today?
What is up, Tony? It is so much fun to be here. I'm really excited. This is kind of one of my dream come trues is dreams come true. I can't even talk. That's how excited I am. Anyways, here we are. Carry on.
Can you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So my name is actually Maria Virginia, but everybody calls me Mari V. So I invite you to join the club. And I'm from Miami, Florida. Lived here for a very long time. And I work in communications at a not-for-profit. So I've gotten to kind of wet my feet in a lot of this fun communication-y things like podcasting. And then now I'm getting to do it for fun, not just for work. So thank you for having me, Tony.
No problem. Thank you for being here. We're really looking forward. I know Father Parrish and I were actually hanging out last night after an interview I did here in Seattle. And he is really excited to have you join our team also. So he actually is going to be coming down to Miami sometime in the next year. So he wants to hang out. So I'm looking forward to you guys getting to meet and chill out together. So how's your weekend? Did you do anything fun over the last week or did you just crash?
I just crashed. We have a big conference coming up at the end of this month for my job. So we're really busy with that. And at this point, it's just sleep as much as you can now because you will not be sleeping for a week once we start our conference.
Yeah, conferences are crazy, and I've never even run one, but I have worked behind the scenes with a lot of conferences, and it is just all hands on deck the entire time. The last time I was actually at a conference, I was one of the keynote speakers, and I was supposed to be at a meeting at 7:30 a.m. in the morning, and I got a wake-up call at like 9:30 because the one like outlet I had picked in my room to plug my phone into was like the one outlet in the room that didn't work. And so my phone had died. I was in a completely different time zone. I was in Florabama, which I don't know if you're familiar with Florabama. It's where the Florida meets the Bama.
It's kind of that Mobile area. Yeah.
And so I totally overslept for that meeting, which was not an essential part of my day. But they were like, I was supposed to do something on main stage at like 9:45. And so I was like, I'm getting ready and running downstairs.
Coming from West Coast to East Coast is harsh. I'm kind of excited because our conference is in California, is in San Francisco. So I'm going to like have the advantage, I feel, going that way.
Nighttime is the opposite, though. It's the best. Like when you go to an adult conference, especially, which I was not, you're wide awake until everybody else is tired. They're going to sleep. They can't hang. And you're just ready to go. So it's always fun going that direction in the evening. It's just getting adjusted to the mornings. That's hard. So I've got a question for you. I know like conferences, big events, parties, like people always try to like approach them in different ways. I went to a party a little while ago where I met our guest for this episode. But one of the questions that I asked her that I want to ask you, Mari V, is when you go to a party, like what's your strategy? Do you try to make a splash? Do you try to like sneak in quietly? Do you have a certain way that you kind of approach, hey, here's how I go to a party?
Generally, I like to bring food. I feel like when you bring food, it doesn't matter who you are welcome to the party. I mean, okay, if you're bringing a drink, you're even more welcome to the party. But generally, I will just be like, here is my offering to the food table. And then people are like, hey, what did you bring? And then they're very excited. I guess, I don't know. I'm trying to like think maybe I'm like masking insecurities by like bringing something, but maybe it's my way to be like on the popular side of the party. But I actually went to a salsa dancing party this weekend and actually danced, which was great. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, definitely trying to always create a connection with people. Like, I guess, find a common conversation thing.
Did you bring salsa to the salsa party?
I did this like 3-layer Mexican dip thing. So it was not like the right region salsa, because like salsa tends to be more Caribbean, but I did literally bring salsa to the salsa party.
I figured you might be the kind of person who would like love that kind of visual or verbal food pun. And so that's awesome. Well, so I actually met the guest that we have today, Lisa Stadler, at a party of sorts. So a little while ago, there was an event for that Patreon hosted, and we use Patreon, which is just a way that creative people or people doing, projects like podcasts or art, books, other things like that, can invite people to support the work that they do. And so I was going to learn how to use Patreon a little bit better, and was there. And it was basically as if you had taken, like I said, we're going to have a party. And in the middle of that party, we're going to have a talk about, like, you know, how to do some of these things. But it's just going to be all of the, like, super creative artsy kids from high school, right? And then all of the, like, really, like, IT, like, technology-oriented kids from high school. And then a lot of, like, the really cool kids that everybody wants to hang out with who are completely oblivious to the fact that everyone wants to hang out with them. And if you eliminated everybody else, right, and just put them in a room and tried to talk about crowdfunding, that's kind of the vibe that this party had. So at the end, they're kind of breaking us into groups, like who does podcasts, who does comics, who does, you know, YouTube channels, and just letting us talk to each other along with some of their staff members. I was talking to my group and I met some cool people who we're going to have on the show later that I'm really excited about. But there was this one person like across the room who never even made it over to the podcast group. And I just saw them. I was like, oh, that's a cool person. And I kept on like trying to dodge around and try to figure out, you know, how do I get to this person? How do I talk to them? Because it was just somebody who kind of like was lighting up their corner of the room. They were getting everybody laughing, having a good time, like really, really at ease engaging people. And I'd gone with my friend Timothy. And before I could even get to her, he kind of met up with her and he was talking to her. And he was like, you've got to come meet this guy I know. So he introduced us actually. And her name is Lisa, like I mentioned. And she runs a podcast called Disagreeable Subjects. And it is basically, in a lot of ways, the political version of what we do here on The Threshold. So I'm really excited to just kind of dive into this conversation with her, Madhavi, to share it with you and to share it with our listeners. So I hope you guys enjoy my conversation with Lisa Stadler from Disagreeable Subjects. And if you could introduce yourself.
I am Liesl Stadler. I run a podcast called Disagreeable Subjects, where the basic premise is that we can discuss really controversial and polarizing issues and still at least try to remain agreeable enough people. Beyond that, I'm really bad at introductions because I always think of weird stuff like, I just got a new carpet this week and I have a cat named Hazmat. So those are two fun things about me.
So Lisa and I met a little while ago at an event for people who use Patreon or are trying to use Patreon to support their creative work. And it was really just a chance introduction, but I've been really excited to sit down and talk with her because there's such close alignment between what we do here on The Threshold and what she does on Disagreeable Subjects. But it's been really cool to just kind of dive into some conversations with her. Lisa, in order to help people get to know you a little bit better, I want to ask you a couple questions that might seem a little bit random, might seem a little bit silly, might seem a little bit disturbing. I don't know. Let's start.
I love random and silly. So, yeah.
So we'll figure out how things go. So when you go to a party, do you slip in? Do you try to make a splash? Do you hide or do you do something else?
So I used to think about this far more analytically. Like I would try to think about what I wanted to do. And then I realized that there's no point in that. Usually when I come into a party, it's going to be a big, loud entrance anyway. I don't know why that's the case. But I think there's something really fun, particularly if you show up to a party like an hour after it's been going, which I think is acceptable for like a house party or something. Everyone is so excited to see you. And that ego boost of when you walk in and people are just like, Liesl, and like so happy that I'm there is pretty awesome. So yeah, I think I just tend to be I don't know. It's not like I have to be the center of attention. It just comes so naturally. So I tend to make something of a splash. Not always, but usually.
What is your favorite thing to complain about?
That's kind of a hard question, I realize, because I think that now that I'm kind of working on the podcast and working independently, a lot of the things that I used to complain about were work-related, you know? And that's like a weird way to bond at work, right? You complain about something and it becomes really toxic and negative, but it's really easy to bond over complaining. So now I don't feel like I complain as much because I'm not in a workplace where complaining is part of bonding.
Mm-hmm. You know, would you go to the mirror and just complain about Liesl? Is that the...
I think I complain about my cat has a tendency. I feel like I'm talking about my cat a lot. Sorry. She's just sitting like in front of me. So I'm just like, ah, there she is. I don't know when she goes crazy and decides it's time to play when you don't really want to play with a 13-pound cat. I guess I complain about that, but I feel very lucky that that's like the biggest complaint of my life, or that I have to like, make sure I return these books to the library on time. You know, I don't have a ton to complain about right now. I'm a very lucky individual, I think.
What is a guilty pleasure you have that you refuse to give up?
Oh, Real Housewives, 100%. It's terrible. I will never make an argument for the Real Housewives being good or like a positive societal force. And it's one of those things that like, if I didn't love it so much, I would actively talk about how terrible it is. But I do. That's just... Real Housewives will always be my guilty pleasure, I think.
What would you like to do if you had a free day in the town that you live? You don't have to pay for anything. You've got, you know, a 24-hour period of time where you can just do anything that you would like to do. What would you do?
So if I had a completely free day where I didn't have to pay for anything in Seattle, where I live, I think I would start probably with going to the Museum of History and Industry, which is a really nerdy response, but it's really cool. And you get to see all the like old wooden boats. And I love like industrial history, or like a history of business of a place, I think is really interesting. So I think I'd probably start there because museums are always better in the morning. I'm assuming I get to pick the weather on this imaginary day as well. So it would be a pretty nice day in Seattle instead of the dreary day that it is right now. I think I would probably do like lunch at Pike Place, because Pike Place clam chowder is amazing. And I rarely like soups because I kind of have a resentment of paying for flavored water. But I think a soup from there would be great. And probably do just kind of some general wandering a little bit. I like to eat a lot. But in Fremont, there's, you know, Brouwer's, the little Belgian brew pub area. And they have like this thing called Stoufflies, which is like a stew poured over their fries, which are really good. And they have a bunch of good whiskeys. So I think I would do, sorry about that. I think I would do like whiskey plus... some Stoufflies. And then at the end of the day, I'd go across the street to Attaball, which is one of those grown-up arcade things. And I would definitely just play arcade games for a while. So yeah, I guess that's my day.
Awesome. And then how do you think thoughts affect reality? And if you do the same thing, answer the question in your response.
I think thoughts affect reality, in a myriad of ways. I remember when I used to be a reasonably religious person, and I believe that there's a proverb that says something about, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. I think it's really difficult to have thoughts that you don't act on, particularly if those are thoughts you dwell upon. So even if it's not like a direct effect where you immediately think of something and then you do it, if you're thinking about how much you resent someone, you're going to start behaving in a way that shows that you resent that person. You know, I think a lot of the time, I guess I see thoughts, particularly ones that we really harbor or dwell on, kind of like keeping, you know, an animal in a box. You can only do it so long, and as soon as you stop monitoring it, it will escape. So I guess I think that thoughts leak out whether we intend them to or not, and they sort of form the realities that we live in by our own actions. Does that kind of make sense?
That's great. So I want to ask you kind of the core question we ask people here on The Threshold, and that's, if somebody walked up to you on the mean streets of Seattle, Washington, and said, hey, could you tell me in a few minutes what you believe about life and faith, how would you respond to that person?
So I think I usually begin responses to that with talking about a little bit of where I came from. I used to be quite religious. I started going to church with my neighbors when I was in eighth grade, because my father was Catholic and my mother was part of the Church of Christ. And they had four kids and were really exhausted. And so neither of them could like really coordinate to take us to church. But I always sort of knew that it was something that at least somewhat mattered to them. And so in eighth grade, I started really wanting a church home and wanting to engage with religion more. So I ended up going to a conservative Baptist church in the town where I lived with my neighbors. And I think I battled and fought so hard for so long to even feel like I was a valid member of the church, because my family didn't go and I was a very loud lady person, which wasn't always encouraged there. I think I realized I was spending so much time throughout high school and then kind of into college trying to make the church be something I could be a part of, that I wasn't spending time on any of the other pursuits that I cared about. I wasn't really raising money for charitable organizations. I wasn't getting involved in my community because I was spending all my time trying to convince usually older men that they should listen to me as a younger woman and that maybe my opinion mattered. And so I think after a while, I started reading more from some atheist philosophers, but I didn't really convert to atheism. I just stopped trying so hard to make Christianity fit. And so where I stand now is sort of this feeling that I describe myself as secular, because I don't feel like it requires that I define my beliefs immediately to everyone, but I see being secular as a way of living. I don't think God is necessary for morality or to be whatever people might consider a good person. And I think I just took a step back for a while. I took a break from trying to fit into an already established religion that was never going to accept me anyway. I had a really hard time believing that. I was actually writing about this last Sunday because I attended church with my aunt, who it was very important to, you know, Easter and all that. And I remember sort of sitting there thinking about how it was so weird that for so many years I tried so hard to be part of the church and felt shot down constantly. And that with the premise that God creates us with a certain set of gifts, and my gifts were definitely those of speaking and yeah, honestly, I think passion is a gift. And I think that's something that I had. But to go back to a church, particularly like the one that I went to before, I would have to be actively telling God I was not going to be the person he created me to be. Mm. And I find that really bizarre. There was a clip they showed of Billy Graham, because this was also, it was sort of a non-denominational Foursquare-like church that I was at last Sunday. And I remember thinking that if Billy Graham had been born a woman, he would not be Billy Graham. No one would have paid attention. And yes, I'm comparing myself a little bit to like one of the greatest evangelists of all time, but you know, so what? Like we have the same set of gifts, you know? And I was constantly told I couldn't morally use mine because I was born in the wrong body for it. So honestly, I think where I stand with faith and religion now is that I've taken a break. I don't really actively believe in a God, but I also realize that there's some inherent part of me that always will. I just don't think that following faith how I was trying to was, it was depleting me. It wasn't doing anything else.
So you mentioned that you specifically were looking for a church home. Like that's one of the things that made you initially kind of seek out going to church with your friends. What were you hoping for in that church home? Like what triggered that desire in you, and what were you hoping a church was going to do to answer that? Do you know?
That's a really good question. I think I really wanted a community. I don't feel like I ever felt like I fit in particularly well. Like I had friends, I wasn't, you know, deprived of those things. But I remember when I was really young, I just found myself really caring a lot about some of the issues that religious people also cared about. You know, they talk a lot about poor people. They talk a lot about what you should do to improve the world around you. And I wanted something of a community where you could actively talk about those things. I also felt like having a community where you're honestly expected to be trying your best at to live the most moral life you can, to do the right thing, to live with integrity. I wanted a community where that was the focus. I think it's easy with like friends or even with family to just, your community can be based on mutual interests or activities you all like or something like that, or proximity, honestly. I think I wanted a community that was based on something more than that. Yeah. So I guess that, I don't know if that's what I was expecting. I think that that's definitely what I wanted though.
What you said, no, you said your parents, you know, were, your dad was, ostensibly Catholic. Your mom was Church of Christ, four kids and could never kind of get it together to get you guys to church on Sunday on a regular basis. What did your faith practice, like what, were there any faith practices at home that you guys lived out, on a regular basis?
We prayed before meals after a while, the bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts one, that was pretty standard. We were pretty close to our grandparents. So with them, we would tend to do things like my mother's father had been a preacher in the Church of Christ for eons, I think. And my father's mother was just, you know, she really loved it when we'd go to church with her. So we always would. And the St. Catherine's in Elmira, not even Eugene. So I guess there were those things. Honestly, I think the thing we did the most religiously was watch The Simpsons together on Sunday night. I don't know. It was odd because it felt like my parents would fall back to this religious default when they were uncomfortable with something. If they didn't like something, they would have a religious explanation for it, but it didn't play a really active role in their lives. My mother is one of those people who is almost too smart for her own good. You know, she's much, much smarter than I am. She's just a truly brilliant woman academically. So, you know, we did a lot of reading, and particularly if you're reading older texts, you know, the Bible and religious, religious cultures come up a whole lot. So a lot of the religious discussions that happened as a result of books we were reading generally, or just sort of cultural questions. I personally, my grandparents always gave us Bibles for presents, and there was actually some kind of cool ones for younger kids that I had. And I don't know. So I just read a lot. So I personally read the Bible a lot, just because that was my gateway into any sort of religious thinking.
What were some of your major takeaways from that? Like reading the Bible, how did scripture strike you?
Honestly, I found it fascinating and awesome. I mean, honestly, I really enjoyed reading the Bible. And the more I studied particular characters that maybe aren't talked about as much, the more I was truly drawn to the idea of a life of faith. I remember, this was a little bit later, sort of in college, I took a course in the Old Testament prophets. And I got the whole, like, yeah, you're supposed to love Jesus, but there's a poem that I really like that mentions, I can no more love you than my guinea pigs can love me. Mm-hmm. You know, like the idea of understanding a God is so limited. So it's a really strange thing to be told to love God. I never quite got that. But in reading the Old Testament prophets, I sort of had this feeling of, these are my people. Like, I totally understand looking around you and thinking, no, none of this is right. I understand that you all, you know, live this way, and you've lived this way for a long time, but I'm pretty sure that's not actually the right way to do it. You know, I kind of understand living at a slightly acute angle to society in that way. And I was really inspired by them. I think it contributed, though, like studying the Bible actually contributed to frustration and confusion with how the churches I attended anyway actually played out, because I did not see the Bible in the churches that I attended, except for a few sporadically chosen verses, honestly. Mm.
Did the fact that they only used scripture sporadically mean anything to you? Why did that bother you? Or did it, I guess?
I think it bothered me because for a couple of reasons. One is that I genuinely wanted to learn from mentors. That's been like the constant sort of sad, or a constant, slightly sad aspect of my life, is that I've always really wanted a true mentor, or, you know, people to really mentor me. And I've never really found that. But I wanted it so badly. And I remember going to Bible classes, and there would be an older person there frequently teaching the class in the position of authority, and I would know more scripture than they would 9 out of 10 times. Mm. And that was frustrating because I still wanted to be led, I guess. I know there's so much I don't understand and I don't know, but when you have, you know, someone who's literally only an authority because they're older than me, it's really hard to grow sometimes. And then you feel shamed for being younger and also being like, but this doesn't seem actually consistent with the Bible you're supposedly preaching out of. Mm-hmm. You start to feel very lonely and like, you know, there's no real place for you because you start to feel unwanted, honestly. If you know the Bible too well, you know, there's always this feeling that, well, they want to continue to live the way they're living. They're comfortable this way. They've built their communities based upon the mentalities that they're preaching to me that I think are wrong. So there's no reason for them to actually listen to what I'm saying or for them to rethink what's going on. The most I can tell them is that they are potentially losing people and not living the way God would want them to live. And that sounds, I mean, I was told I was, it's odd because I don't think I'm arrogant, but I definitely was told that that was, you know, that I was being arrogant when I would point out biblical verses that would challenge what they were saying, because I got the whole, well, it's been this way for a long time and people have actually studied this. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. But it still means they can be wrong. So I don't know. I think loneliness was really something that I associate with the years that I was trying to fit into a church.
Now, you are at this place now where you are really trying to encourage people to have these kind of healthy dialogues around disagreeable subjects. Where did that desire come from?
Honestly, it initially started from years and years of not doing that. I was always a debater, I guess. Like, I wasn't formally part of debate clubs, but, you know, I would just argue the opposite side of an issue because nobody was something I pretty frequently did. Something I kind of still do. There is a Christopher Hitchens book called Letters to a Young Contrarian, that just like spoke to my soul because I'm something of a contrarian. And I realized sort of after a while that that was just like a sport for me. That was kind of a game. It wasn't really getting anywhere. I wasn't really convincing anyone of anything. So I started thinking about what I actually would want to convince people of. And I came away feeling like, well, people should be convinced that there's nuance, that there's a lot of, there are many reasons why somebody might believe something differently than you do. And I think I also had the privilege of meeting a lot of smart people from wildly different ideological backgrounds and sort of realized that no matter what I believe, there's going to be somebody a lot smarter than me who believes the exact opposite. Like, that's just a rule of life, I think. And so there's no point in approaching an issue guns blazing as though, you know, I'm the only one who can possibly be right and there's no legitimate reason to disagree with me. That just turns people off. And also, you're probably at least wrong about some things and you're certainly not the smartest person on the planet who's engaging in this argument. So I started wanting to look for nuance and I wanted to have the time and ability to make that meaningful. So the podcast came a little bit from the idea that, well, if I'm going to dive into these things and really explore them, maybe the best thing I could do is really record that exploration, make it okay to have real questions, give it a space outside of Facebook comments to flourish, you know, I envision a society in which we're able to debate and argue and sometimes not end up convincing anyone or always agreeing, but in which we understand each other a little bit better at the end of the day. And so that's what I guess I hope to create through it.
What do you think some of the biggest barriers to those type of conversations are in our society today?
So I think a lot of how we react to other people asking questions comes from things we've experienced before. So I think of a dozen examples pretty easily right off the top of my head, in which we'll be having a conversation and somebody will say something or use a phrase that I've heard in a context that I would see as very negative, and I automatically have an emotional response that's sort of negative to that. Probably doesn't have anything to do with what they're actually trying to say. It has to do with the associations I have with experiences in my past where similar phrases have been used, or, you know, things I'm invested in believing. And so, you know, I think about, sorry, I'm trying to narrow down the examples.
No, take your time.
You know, things, yeah, things like, you know, speaking to, you know, something that I've done a lot of research on in the past for various reasons is child sex abuse. And in any, there's a myriad of situations in that can sort of make that worse. But I remember speaking with a Catholic friend of mine, and we weren't even talking about child sex abuse in the church, but he brought it up and talked about how overblown it is and how it's even worse in teachers' unions. And that was his knee-jerk reaction. And I was just kind of like, well, first, you're not doing yourself any favors by like immediately becoming really defensive when we're talking about, you know, this topic. You know, second, I feel like what I hear when you say that is that you're unwilling to examine the ways in which it is terrible in something you're a part of. You're not part of a teacher's union. You are part of the Catholic Church. One of these then is more your responsibility than the other. And you're being defensive of the thing you're a part of doesn't necessarily move any conversation forward. It doesn't convince anyone to, you know, that the Catholic Church wasn't, you know, somehow that you shouldn't completely write it off. It just makes you look defensive. So I guess I think of that as an example of a conversation that we were talking about a heavy issue, child sex abuse. Not a great thing anybody wants to spend a whole lot of time thinking about. But there are ways you can talk about it that aren't inherently defensive. And sometimes that comes from, you know, just sort of our own feelings we already have coming in. I have no doubt that there are people he's had conversations with who immediately wanted to make him answerable to what a priest who was behaving extraordinarily badly might have done. I can see why he would feel defensive and frustrated by that. But I think that those things we then carry forward with us into every conversation we have, even when they're not appropriate.
If you had to pick one topic that you could get people across the world to have a healthy conversation about that's disagreeable in our world today, what's one conversation you would love to see everyone having?
That is a very good question. Oddly enough, it might be child sex abuse, actually. For several reasons. One is that it doesn't get talked about nearly as often as it should. It is a truly like societal wide problem. It's definitely a problem in many areas of the globe where we never address it. I remember talking to my grandmother who's from Newfoundland, and Newfoundland is one of the most glorious places on the planet. But there was a book that came out in which that it was set in Newfoundland, and there was a passing mention of child sex abuse in it. And she just said, that doesn't happen there. I'm like, well, you know, odds are it does. You know, I'm not going to get into a huge argument with my grandma about the fact that this is real all over the world, but it is. I also think it challenges notions of how someone becomes a predator and what we do with them. I feel like the more I delved into the issues of child sex abuse, the more I felt like, first, I tend to believe in general, criminals are made, not born. And the vast majority of people who are child sex abusers have been themselves abused. Like, it doesn't justify it doesn't make it okay, but sometimes even saying that, people get a little up in arms as though you're somehow justifying it. You don't have to be justifying it to be able to see that there's something that maybe if we know the problem, we can work on an actual solution instead of just hoping we can imprison someone before they do too much damage. I also think it makes us uncomfortable to think about the idea that maybe there are policies that we've passed that make us more comfortable with how we treat pedophiles and child sexual abusers that aren't effective. So one that I immediately think of are housing policies that relegate people who have been convicted of any sort of sexual crime to only certain areas, or they have to be a certain distance away from a school or a park or a library or anything like that. Those are a massive failure. They move someone away from their community that, usually having close ties to your family and community, having some normalcy, an ability to gain income, those things actually reduce recidivism, even in cases of child sexual abuse, more than most anything else. So you've actually now taken somebody and removed them from all those things that would lower recidivism rates. Additionally, you're putting them, you know, they're able to live in neighborhoods without schools, parks, libraries. Those tend to be poor neighborhoods. There are still kids who live there. We're just deciding that it's better to put now this child sexual abuser who is more prime for recidivism near the poor kids.
Hmm.
There are so many issues with these policies, but they have so much popular support because it sounds reasonable to say, well, just keep them away from society, when really we're just keeping them away from certain sectors of society and pushing them toward others. So I feel like that issue, it encompasses so many things, you know, where criminals come from, how we could potentially, you know, are there cures? What does it look like? Are there any therapies that could be devised? How we can, you know, treat criminals after they've served time. And then also just, I think it's so horrible. Everyone wants to look away, and that's totally understandable, but looking away doesn't solve it. Looking away doesn't help it. Doesn't change it at all. There's, so my, you know, something that the reason I started focusing on that particular issue so much for so long is that my younger sister was raped from the ages of 6 to 12 by the guy who took us to church when we were younger. And she came out and told me when she was 20, and he's now in prison for 16 years to life. And he's like in his 70s, so he'll probably die there, which is a weirdly like happy ending. Like most people don't get this like extended prison sentence, you know, to, I guess, make up for, to see some justice in it. But the more we talked about it, the more people who, it was just incredibly common to be talking about this story of my sister's and have so many women and men were just like, oh yeah, me too. Like that also happened to me, or this thing happened when I was younger and it was the babysitter and my mom just told me to forget about it. Or, you know, I was talking to my sister and I had the same second grade teacher, just, you know, some time apart. And I was talking to her about it and she just said, oh yeah, like here was my experience. You know, it's like so many people in our lives have experienced this and we never talk about it. And it's a horrific crime being done to the most vulnerable people in society. And so, yeah, I guess if I could pick one issue, sorry, that's a very long answer, but I think it would be that.
It's very real. It's very personal. Like that's I think one of the big things. And I think, you know, on that particular topic, and especially with what you mentioned at the end, it is far more common, but it is also one of the most isolating experiences that people can have, because you don't know who to tell or how to tell, and people don't know how to talk about it in a way that doesn't, that seeks, hey, what is actually best for everyone in this situation? Because there's a desire to punish those who have victimized somebody. There's a desire to protect those who have, but there's also all the human relationships that get caught up in that, that make it so hard, because we don't realize how systemically people are affected by this, because one person who's sharing their story may know there's a lot of people in the room, but they don't know who they are and they don't know what their story is and they don't know how that all plays into it. So, I think that is a great example of a topic that most people would have a hard time sharing around. And that, you did a really good job of exploring both sides of that and modeling exactly what you're wanting people to kind of engage in. So I really appreciate that. I thought that was a great answer.
Can I add real quick? Yeah. That I do, you know, I mentioned that it was the people who took us to church, and I feel like sometimes there are people who do turn away from the church because of it. But something that I sort of want to point out about that particular situation is that the pastor at the church was a different one than the one we grew up with, but he was amazing. Like when he found this out and when this was something that was sort of coming to the fore, like he handled it exactly how I think churches should. Like he was very like, well, we still have to care about his soul. So there's an elder who'll be assigned to him to care about that. But he immediately, the police didn't, well, they did know already, but he didn't know that. So when he found out, he told the police, which is like a thing you should do when child sex abuse happens. And he, you know, made sure that Maria, my sister, felt cared about first. and didn't try to push, oh, well, now you have to forgive. He understood healing had to happen. And, you know, he talked to the whole church about it and how to talk to kids. It was just amazing. So I do kind of want to point out that positive religious example, I guess, because I think so often it ends up being very negative, or people have had very negative experiences within the church with this. And this wasn't one of them, I guess.
No, that's great. And I, you know, like there's a part of me as a church worker, as somebody who is religious, who deeply is curious about those things in any situation, but it's also one of those things you don't ever ask. So I really appreciate, I mean, you know, unless, I mean, you can, but it's one of those things where it's just like, did they do a good job? Sounds like a really self-serving question.
I understand, though. Yeah. And, you know, and it was so, honestly, I was so ready. I was so almost expecting it to be terrible. And when he was awesome, I actually even asked him, because I talked to him after. He actually works with, he is the Conservative Baptist Church guy and Grace Baptist down in White Salmon. And I was like, do you help other churches with this? And he's like, oh yeah, we're just rewriting everything about how we do, you know, about how we do this. And like, he consults with other people about it, which was just really cool. Like, I don't know. It makes you feel like, okay, like there's some hope, there's some progress. Like this is dealt with in the best possible way. And that's really cool.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I really appreciated sitting down and just talking with you, hearing about kind of what you believe, what shaped that belief, and why it matters. At the end of every conversation, I offer two things. One is that if you have a question for me, I'd be happy to answer it. It can be about something we've talked about, something completely different, whatever hits you. But do you have any questions you'd like to ask me?
Something I wonder about a little bit with religious people that I like, that sounds terrible, but, I think that so often I am hesitant to say I'm living in the secular way and I'm not really doing church stuff right now, because I immediately expect them to see me as a project, you know, to now our friendship will entirely be about converting me to Christianity somehow. Mm-hmm. Or making me go back to church, or I don't know. I feel like they stop seeing me. They start seeing, you know, their duty as a religious person, which I guess is not just Christians who do this. It's just they're the ones I tend to encounter more often. And so I'm curious, like, how do you as a religious person kind of walk that line of, I know that evangelism is important. And if you believe something is right and would save someone's soul, it's a good thing to share that. But how do you see people for who they are and not make them feel like projects, and then also spread, you know, gospel message?
Yeah. So it's hard for me. And here's why it's hard specifically for me. I'm a very strategic thinker. It's my primary lens in the world. And so I have 14 years as a youth minister. And so when you go into a new parish or when you're being asked to build a program, it's really easy to start looking at any person, not so much as an individual you want to have a relationship with, or that you want to help grow in their faith, or that you want to disciple or mentor, but as not just a project sometimes, but as a useful resource, which is almost worse. Like, I feel like project, at least there's interaction. Useful resource is just like looking at a person as a thing. Because you might know, like, hey, if we can get this person coming to youth ministry, if we can get this person engaged in their faith, and they're going to bring in all these other people with them, right? And there are large evangelical organizations that I work with that I like, that I think do great work, but I hear that language regularly in the way that they talk about people, right? And that's a reality. Like, I very much know that that's a thing, and I know it's a place where I've had to challenge myself a whole lot to not get caught in the trap of thinking about people as projects or as resources. So that's something that's very real to me. A big part of it is realizing that most of the time we are trying to anticipate or jump ahead in our conversation to the point where we can communicate our idea about what a person should do, should be, whatever. And that just keeps us from receiving them. And that's a significant block to a relationship. And it doesn't matter whether it's church evangelism, whether it's moralism about you don't agree with somebody's way of life or their political ideology, whatever. If you're just waiting for your point to tell somebody they're wrong or why your side is right, you're automatically cutting off just receiving them and being receptive to them. And for me, like, I ultimately find that to be a very non-Christ-centered approach. And it's also not what Jesus did. Like, Jesus deeply received people. He would already know everything about a person's life according to scripture. Like, if you believe in Jesus, if you believe in his word, like, he would know everything about somebody and still ask them questions and listen to their answers and engage them in a full relationship because he desired to receive them so that he could be in an actual relationship with them. And so for me, it's really just kind of coming back to a very essential nature of, like, Jesus didn't do that. Like, Jesus didn't treat people like projects. He didn't treat people like resources. He received people who he knew were going to reject him. He received people who were completely at odds with who he was, and he just fully received them. And that love itself, right, that love which we believe he was, is what went to work in those people's life. Ultimately, the resolution comes that it's not really either or. It's that fully receiving and being in a relationship with a person, it changes you and it changes them. And if I'm seeking to be the best version of myself, right, the person who I feel like I was ultimately created to be, and I desire to help other people become that person, which I believe means hopefully an encounter with God in that person's life, because that's where I believe true transformation is going to come from, the best thing I can do is to receive that person well and actually be in a relationship with them in the way that I feel like Christ models completely and thoroughly, because that's where love goes to work, right? That's where good takes off. That's where beautiful and true things become existent. And so it's not easy for me. I'm not perfect at it. And honestly, moving to Seattle from Dallas, Texas, that was a big part of the attraction. I didn't have to live in a place where there was so much Christian mediocrity and culture that nobody ever actually really got into a place of vulnerability with each other, because we were all terrified of not being a valid enough Christian, right? We were all horrified of that somebody would realize we weren't as good as we thought we were. So you had to walk the walk, talk the talk, and it was hard to be real and be vulnerable. And so moving to Seattle, where people, even if they disagree with you, are at least honest about it and open about it and real about it, and sometimes angry and closed off about it, right? Like, I mean, it's whatever. That seemed like a much more fruitful place for me to be in than where I was at. And so I don't know if that answers the question or not, but that's kind of what I think about when I think about this stuff.
I think it does. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really good answer, honestly.
And then, so the second thing that I offer people at the end of any episode is just, if they're open to it, I'd love to pray for you. Obviously you're a secular person, so I wouldn't invite you to pray with me, but if you're not open to it, that's okay. The answer no is totally fine. But if you are open to it, I would love to.
I'm not anti-prayer. I mean, that's fine. I never, even when I was religious, knew how to respond to that question, because I always had this feeling that, well, then I'm taking up prayer space that maybe somebody else needs more. Like, I think that's sort of a weird thought I have, but I always think that way when somebody asks that question.
I love that. Like, and that's, I want you to know that's not an uncommon response.
Oh, good.
Right. Like, I hear people all the time tell me, like, well, you could be praying for something, like, you could be praying for start. Here's the thing, especially with what I just said, you're the person who I'm trying to receive right now, right? You're the person who I also desire to give what I think is something good to. And if you're willing to receive that, that's great. And if you're not, that's okay. I don't want to force anything on somebody. But the reality is, the best good that we can do, like the church teaches, right, which we believe comes from Jesus, that there's two principles that get thrown around a lot politically. But one of them is solidarity, which means that we are in unity with each other and with the rest of the human race. But the other one's also subsidiarity. And people try to pit these two against each other. The reality is they exist in collaboration. But subsidiarity is the people closest to an issue are the best ones to deal with the issue. And so the reality is, right now, you're the person who I'm here with in this conversation. And so there's no one else who should take up prayer space, because you, even though I'm in unity with the entirety of creation, are the person who I am most present to right now. And therefore, out of all of creation, right, I should be most present to you. And that is the most proper place to deposit that goodness, hopefully, right? Does that make sense at all? I don't know.
It does. Okay. I never thought about it that way. But yeah,
so
that's fine.
So here's the thing I want to point out. Like, I usually don't point out things before prayer, but there are a couple of things that really stood out to me when you were talking. And I'm going to pray about a couple of them. But the big, like, thing that I circled down at one point, like, you wrote, like you were looking for a church home, but you were a loud lady person, right? And I wrote that down and I underlined loud lady person.
Yep.
But there are a couple other things you talked about. You talked about like this desire to experience good and to share good and this desire to really kind of challenge people, a lot of the work that you're doing, and also this desire for mentorship. And it made me originally think just of the story of Elijah and Elisha, which are Old Testament stories. And I don't know if you're familiar with that particular jam or not, but it's the story of one prophet mentoring another. And it immediately just fit with me and you. So I wanted to give you a little bit of context for that before I pray, or maybe those listening, a little context before that. Because that story for me resonated very clearly in what you seem to be seeking. And so I'm going to use some of that language, but I wanted to be a little bit more transparent about it than I normally am for whatever reason. I don't know why wanted to right now. So
that's interesting.
I'm going to begin in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. God, I just ask that you would come in your goodness and that you would bless Liesl and the work that she is doing and the voice that you have given her and the prophetic power and spirit that you have placed upon her heart. As a person who is engaging deeply with a secular reality, God, but that's a reality I believe you created. She's speaking powerfully to the good and true and beautiful things in this world. And so I would ask that you would continually stir up in her that desire to help those conversations happen, to challenge people who have a hard time listening, but in a way that they can receive it, in a way that lets the prophetic voice that you've placed deep in her heart gain hold and create fruit in their lives. I ask that you would send her mentors, send her people who can lay their mantle across her shoulders and help form within her all the good gifts that you have given her. And I hope in this that she would find peace and joy and success. And we ask all these things through Christ our Lord. Amen. So, Liesl, tell people a little bit more about where they can find you chatting more about disagreeable subjects.
Yeah, you can find disagreeable subjects. Well, first, if you just type in like disagreeable subjects, I think it's actually the first Google result. So that's always...
You got some pretty good SEO, I am saying. Yeah, it's pretty good.
My name, and I didn't even spell it right and it came up. Sorry, I just fat fingered the keys just to double check. You know, there's that. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, all the other podcasty things that people show up on. You can find Disagreeable Subjects there or disagreeablesubjects.com. Also a good place to look, particularly if you're looking for resources that I reference, because I do a lot of research, so all the show notes are there as well. Also, we have, of course, a Facebook page. So if you just type in Disagreeable Subjects on Facebook, we come up there. And that's where I post things, not only the podcast, but also starting a new feature called Logical Fallacy of the Week, so that we can spot logical fallacies in arguments that we see in the media or just in our everyday lives, because it's really easy to hear about logical fallacies, think they're interesting, and then not have them present in our minds when we're having an actual discussion in real life. So I think it'd be kind of fun to learn about that. Also movie reviews of disagreeable movies. So things that have to do with rhetoric and politics and how we actually interact with each other on major issues. I'm watching movies based upon those and talking about them and some of the lessons we can learn from them. So first one I'm going to talk about is The Death of Stalin, which is an amazing movie that everyone should watch. If you have not...
It looks so good.
It is so good. I've seen it twice now. It's ridiculous because I saw it with my mom and then I had to make other people go see it with me. So I can't wait to talk about that because it's incredible. I mean, there's a lot of swearing and some, you know, and it's a violent movie because it's Stalinist Russia and that's kind of a thing. So there's that. But so good. Anyway, so yeah, definitely follow us on Facebook because that's where I'll be posting some of those things.
Hey guys, before we jump into our wrap-up conversation here on The Threshold, I wanted to tell you about two great ways that you can support our podcast and support other great things too. Season 2, obviously, is just launching with this episode. We really are thankful
to Liesl and to Joe and to Johnny and to all the people who make the podcast happen, especially our great editor, Mark Guiney, over at Radio Heart Media. It's such a thrill to be a part of this, but we need your help to continue to make it happen. If you would consider becoming a patron of The Threshold over at patreon.com/thethresholdpodcast, here's a couple things that you can get if you become a patron beyond just supporting the work we do. You can get access to the unedited episodes a little bit early. That's the interview that I do with our guests. You get it about a week ahead of time, and it's unedited. So there's maybe some extra content, some extra questions. And that's just for $2 a month, cheaper than one cup of coffee a month. You can also get things like extra episodes throughout the course of the month at higher levels. We're also doing this really cool artwork by Johnny Os Isarena. Every episode on the show this time, once a month, we take one of those and we actually make it into kind of like a little card that we will send you at the mail at higher levels. And then we're also doing, because all the art's kind of Sailor Jerry tattoo style, which is one of my favorite aesthetics, we're going to do like a flash sheet. If you don't know what a flash sheet is, when you go into a tattoo parlor, it's what's up on the wall. And you can say, hey, I want, you know, this tattoo or that tattoo. I kind of like this one and this one. And we're going to do a flash sheet at the end of the season with all of our different art. And then at the highest level, you actually can get a shirt and become a guest on the show. We know a lot of people can't support at that level besides my mom. Thanks, Mom. But we would love to have you consider supporting The Threshold. If we can get enough patrons, we're actually going to be able to go back to weekly episodes, which we would love to do. Finances, time, and other things just don't allow it right now. So please consider supporting that. Don't want to do that? That's totally okay. Another great way you can support us is going to CatholicBalm.co. Catholic Balm Co. is amazing lip balms, beard balms, and lotion bars inspired by the Catholic tradition. You may be thinking, Tony, I'm Catholic. Will this help me achieve sainthood? And we can't make that commitment or that promise. We don't know of anybody who that's been the case for. We hope that nobody who's bought Catholic beard balm has died. And you might be thinking on the other side, Tony, I'm not Catholic. You know, would I be interested in this? Would it cause me to burst into flames? And we have zero, absolutely zero reports of anyone bursting into flames from using any of our products. But with Father's Day coming up, I'd love to have you guys go to CatholicBalm.co/Father's Day, or just search Catholic Balm Co. Father's Day on the internet, or look in our show notes, and you can use the promotional code Knock Knock to get 10% off your order and let us know that you heard about us here on the podcast. And I hand make everything. I hand make everything with my good buddy, Michael Romo. And we really would love to have you try it out this Father's Day. Again, that's CatholicBalm.co, or click on the link in the show notes for either of these two things. And we would love to have you use the promo code Knock Knock when you check out to let us know you heard about it here. So here we go with my conversation with our new co-host, Maddie B. So, Maddie B, what did you think about my conversation with Liesl? What stood out to you from it?
A lot of things stood out to me. But first of all, wow. Like, I can totally see why you were trying to seek Liesl out and to talk to her, because she is amazing. And what she has been able to accomplish through her podcast, I mean, I feel like the whole time during the 2016 election, I was trying to find a way to try to bridge the gap between my friends who were like far left and far right, and be like, can't we like find things in common that we want to still talk about? Can we not like break up friendships because of politics? So I love that she is able to facilitate conversations and be like, hey, we're people and we need to talk about this stuff.
I always feel like I have a really hard time getting guests, right? Like, I mean, and that's, you know, we're like, it's a freshman podcast. It's a complicated subject, but I'm always just blown away whenever I'm talking to her. She's like, oh, I'm talking to our state senator today. I've got a call with somebody in Washington later. I've got like, you know, there's a gun rights, like there's all these people who are like actually doing all of this work that she's coming in and having to sit down with her, or she's going to. And I was just like, how do you not only do that? Like, how do you put yourself out there like that? But how do you navigate the bureaucracy that you have to navigate in order to make that happen? So yeah, it's really cool to see her really kind of cutting across party lines to really engaging deeply in these conversations. I think it's like tremendous, especially for somebody who just like, it's like, I'm going to do it. She hasn't been doing it for a long time. It's just really, really, really awesome. What else stood out to you?
I think the thing that I think when I was listening to it, I wrote down what she said about how there's always going to be, like, no matter what you believe and how strongly you believe it, there's always going to be somebody smarter than you who believes the exact opposite. And I was like, oh, you're so right. Like, I kind of hate that she's so right, but at the same time, she's so right. And like, how do I, with intelligence, engage in conversation where it's not like, well, this is what I believe and that, you know, deal with it. No, you can't approach subjects like that if you truly want to, first of all, connect with another human being. Because I feel like, even though, like, I'm Roman Catholic, so even within my denomination faith, there are so many different opinions about so many things. So even being within one religious group, which she's not part of a religious group, but even being within one, how do you engage with people who believe the opposite idea or a very different idea from what you believe? So I think her concept is so applicable to every aspect of life, not just, you know, religion or politics or really big life issues. But one of the things I kind of wish you guys had delved into was, how do you have a conversation about a disagreeable subject? I feel like that was the only thing that I wish we could have talked about.
Well, I have good news for you, Mari Vias. I have good news for our Patreon subscribers. I do have an extra clip where I talk with Liesl about that specifically. That's going to go up as bonus content on our Patreon this week, and you will have access to that all.
Okay, great. I am excited because I hate, like, I am very non-confrontational and I hate disagreeing with people. And I'm always like skirting issues and trying to like be like the nice person. And it's hard, but sometimes you have to. I mean, when there's something that you very passionately believe, you have to know how to talk about it in an intelligent way, but with conviction and authenticity.
Mm, yeah.
So you don't want to sound like you're kind of coming out of a can, like, you know, it's a canned message. So this is the spiel. And I kind of see that in when she talks about her church experience and how sometimes she really believed something different than what that church leader was sharing. And they didn't know how to engage her and how to have that conversation. Okay, well, you know, we believe this doctrine because it's established and for all these reasons, but, you know, why can't you have a conversation where you question it or explore it deeper?
Right. And I like what you said about, you know, there's always going to be somebody who's smarter who disagrees with you. But I also think a lot of people, they dismiss people because they're like, oh, I'm smarter than you. It's not even, and you might be smarter than the person you're disagreeing with, right? I think what's really important is knowing that you also may still have something to learn from them. You know, like, you may still, like, there are things that, having worked with youth for years, there are things that youth will say or experiences that I have with them that still teach me something that I was unaware of. And it's easy to close ourselves off to that, you know, with anybody, with everybody. It's not just with young people. But I think there's such an importance to be aware that good information oftentimes comes from unexpected sources, especially sources who have a very different perspective than you do. People who have lived a very different life. Like that for me, I think was one of the hardest parts to listen to, was kind of the dismissed nature that she had, because not only that she was young, because I actually feel like if she was a young man, what she said about Billy Graham really resonated with me, right? If she had been a young man and she had wanted to disagree, there's a good chance that that may have been cultivated into a deeper curiosity for, or deeper ability to teach, to proclaim, to, you know, argue about these things, because that may have been accepted. Now, maybe it wouldn't have been. Maybe it would just been like, sit down, youngster, I don't care. But I think there's a lot of times that we are really weeding out strong, passionate, prophetic voices within our church because they disagree, right? People who sense something here that is bigger that they don't necessarily know how to articulate, or maybe they actually do, but we're not well-formed in exactly what you were talking about, that ability to have the real conversation and dive more deeply into it. And so I do wonder, like, how many prophetic voices have we lost? How many people who would compete well and challenge and force us to be a better version of ourselves as churches or as organizations or even as families sometimes, that we've just dismissed because they're young, they're the wrong gender, they come from a different background, they don't have a degree, whatever the case may be, for us to dismiss them, we haven't invited them. And have you ever experienced that? Have you ever kind of been in a place where you felt like, if I was a man or if I was older, you would listen to me and I know I'm right?
Being involved in church ministry for I don't know, forever. But I've been serving in church music ministry for about 18 years since I was a teenager. And the part of church ministry that I really, the music ministry that I really gravitated towards was being a sound tech and working in that particular aspect of music. It's very unusual for a young woman to be doing that. It's usually the, you know, there's a reason they call them the sound guy. And I would always say like, oh, I'm the sound guy. And I'd do air quotes, you know, but after a while, you know, people got to know me and knew, okay, well, she knows what she's talking about, or she's, you know, I'm not short, I'm rather tall. So I carry around my own gear and I'll unpack my SUV with all the sound equipment and I'll set it up. And it's kind of a place where you have to gain respect from others, where they don't assume that you're that technically minded or that you know what you're doing. But then it's like, hey, you know, it sounds really good, so I think I know what I'm doing.
Right.
But it's definitely something that when I heard her talking about Billy Graham, I immediately thought about this, I guess, stereotypically lesser known woman evangelist that I learned about growing up named Catherine Coleman. And she was essentially a female Billy Graham. She died, I think, in the 80s. So she, you know, she isn't as well known nowadays, but she was just as charismatic and very, you know, widely known in her time. So I think that it is possible for women to be heard, and I think more now than ever. But I still think that there is, she talked about being, you know, the loud woman. And I think of the, you know, the whole hashtag nasty woman thing that was around I think it was last year. There's also the nevertheless, she persisted. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of really great memes that came out of that. And there was a really cool one that I actually liked a lot, which was one of Mary, the mother of Jesus. And it was like hashtag nevertheless, she persisted. Yeah. So I think there are a lot of really great female role models that we can look to, you know, in history, in the present, who are accomplishing it. But at the same time, it's kind of like that church leadership kind of getting, learning more, I think, as church leadership gets more diverse and there are more opportunities for women to serve. I remember being on the first team of girl altar servers at my church. And I know that people feel very strongly about that in various things, but for me, it was a really cool opportunity to get to be close to the altar in a very special way. Mm-hmm. And that kind of laid the groundwork for being part of other ministries. And I never had any intention of wanting to become a priest. It wasn't something that I felt drawn to, but it was something very special to be able to be close to the altar and to be able to serve in that way. So I don't know. Maybe I'm from more of a progressive Catholic side of things.
That's all right. Conservative Catholics, if they listen, like massively conservative Catholics. I don't just mean Orthodox believers, people for whom conservatism is a high value. If they listen to our podcast, it's only to be angry.
Yeah. And ironically, on the political side, I'm very conservative, but there are certain things on social issues where it's like, it just makes sense, people. But then that's me.
I think that's why it's important that like we do actually have these hard conversations that you know Liesl is really trying to promote. I also really loved that, you know, like the way she was able to speak clearly about child abuse and the way that's impacted her. You know, even if it's not her directly, but secondhand through somebody very close to her, that's something that is such a hard issue. And I feel like I'd be remiss as a Catholic to not like acknowledge it. I don't want to just gloss over that. I think it is such an important issue, and it is such an isolating thing when people experience that, whether that's, you know, it happens to you or it happens to somebody near you. You don't know who to talk to. You don't know how to talk about it. And there really is a need for people to reach out and kind of break down some of the stigma about that. The amount of the percentage of people who experience some level of sexual abuse within their lifetime is actually a startlingly high statistic that I can't remember exactly right now. So I will put it down in the show notes. And a lot of times it's not even reported. There's no conversation about it. There's no healing. There's no anything else. And that impacts. I mean, I have people who come out to me on a regular basis who are adults who were abused as a child and were just basically just either held it in or they told a parent and that parent's like, well, like, they're old and they're lonely, and so, like, you know, we won't let it happen again, but... And it's not about the punishment, but it's about the shame and the dismissive nature of it that is such a hard thing. And so figuring out how to help break down that conversation and how to start to open people up, because there's a lot of hurt and there's a lot of danger. Like, there are people out there who still are doing that to people who have been doing it for years. And we have to figure out how to talk about that better. And because of our own hangups around it, the church oftentimes is one of the areas where it is, by which I mean the Catholic Church, it's the hardest to talk about, because we don't know how people are going to receive it. So I really appreciated what she said also.
Yeah, something that I really appreciate that I know a lot of dioceses around the country have done, but it's kind of set up training for people who work with youth. And as somebody that has that works with youth, I have also had to do different training courses, and it's really ongoing. And I remember when they first started it, I was so startled by the statistics and by the ways that people approach children and groom them for this. And it was something that I'd never heard about until there was this need, and it was kind of reactionary. And I feel like I'm hoping that we're getting past through, it's been like, 10 years already that there's been a lot of training and on this for people who work with youth in the Catholic Church. So I feel like we're in a better place than we were before. I mean, I think it's more proactive in the way of not trying to avoid creating situations where things like this can happen and being aware of it. But I guess it's still a very long way to go. And just the healing component, it's like, how do you have that conversation? And maybe that's a disagreeable subject conversation that I don't know if you've already addressed it on the threshold, but it could be a really interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, Lisa and I, actually, we talk regularly. We want to do a couple of live events together. And I really do think it would be interesting to have that conversation from a church and political standpoint, because that's kind of what we want to do. We want to get together and have some events where we can talk about things that people aren't talking about, and then talk about both the very human and the very spiritual dimension of those things. So I'll look forward to sharing that with people, hopefully, as they come up. But I think the important thing is just to, again, like she was talking about, not to become defensive, to acknowledge this was an issue, to understand that issue extends beyond just one church. It is a human reality that we need to address better. And then to really figure out how we engage in that conversation in a way that respects everybody's needs. I have a friend who just joined me in the room. My buddy Freya just came in. And so she is hanging out with us for the day. So I'm going to get going soon. Marty, if people want to find you online, on the internet, in the digital world, how do they do that?
So yes, I am on the interwebs. They can find me on Instagram at TheMariVi, TheMariVi. And I'm also doing a little blog called becomingmissright.com. So I don't know, we'll see where that blog ends up, but they're welcome to follow me, get in touch, hit me up.
Now, if you want to follow what we do here on The Threshold online, you can go to facebook.com/thresholdpodcast. We've also got a discussion group where we post the different episodes. The number one thing you can actually do to help support us is to just share an episode. If you hear something that you like, that resonates with you, some good, true, or beautiful thing that you think people should talk about more, share that on Facebook, tweet it on Twitter, whatever you do, just, download it on a floppy diskette and go and throw it, out in the street. Don't do that. That's littering. But just share it with a friend.
Only if it's a 5.5-inch floppy. I feel like those are cool. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Hipsters love those. People just wear them around their necks in Seattle. So anyway.
Are you serious?
I'm just kidding.
Please don't. Okay, good. Sorry. Keep going.
So with that said, again, like we mentioned in the mid-ad break, and that's come up a couple times and is kind of tantamount to how we met Liesl, we do have a Patreon page, so if you want to support us a little bit more, here's a couple things that you get that I really love that we're able to do now. You get episodes, the unedited episodes. So we usually have to cut a couple things out of episodes. You get the full conversation, and you get them about a week before they go up. It's just the rough cut that Marty V and I listen to prepare for the conversation. You'll also get little bonus pieces of content. Like I mentioned, Liesl, we have one about how to have a disagreeable conversation. It's going to go up later on this week also, too. So keep an eye on all those things. There's also more goodies. You can check out those things at patreon.com/thethresholdpodcast, or go to the show notes down below for any and all of that information. We want to thank our sponsors for this episode, Catholic Balm Co. And so until next time, just want to encourage you guys to get out there to FNF ability and to talk about what really matters. Talk to you guys later.